Anna Sheridan, missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. How did I talk to the spirit?
Someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil. There's no place for ghost stories in this investigation or any other.
I need you to find me.
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of IGN Unfiltered. It's the monthly interview show where I very much enjoy sitting down with the best, brightest, most interesting minds in the games industry. And I am so pleased to be joined by someone who I haven't seen in a couple of years.
No?
Peter Molyneux, legendary game designer. Wow. Your resume, which we're going to get well into,
is, or CV, I suppose I should say. I've just got one thing to say on that. I think the dictionary definition of the word legendary means that the person has to be dead.
Okay.
Renowned? You know, I could be on life support here or something, but renowned would do.
All right. Well, Peter Molyneux, you know him from games like Populous, Theme Park, Dungeon Keeper, Black and White, the Fable series, on forward to what you're doing now at 22 Cans. And so if you look at those games, Peter, here's where I want to start with you. There's a common theme to a lot of those games, and that's many of them are God games, and that's really how you made your name.
Yes.
What is it about you psychologically that you think has drawn you to making games where you're God?
Well, the actual honest answer is that I love. Well, I'll actually tell you the real answer,
please.
And the real answer is that when I was a kid. I don't think I've ever told this story. I read this short story, and I think it was by Ray Bradbury, and it was a short story of this family that had this little house with these little characters in them. They cared for these little characters, and in the end, the little characters turned on the family and killed them horribly. You know, it's like a 1950s sci-fi story. They never end well.
Yeah.
And I have always remembered the feeling of what it would have been like to have this little world that you controlled and allowing you to be kind of kind and cruel, allowing you to be nurturing and nice as well as nasty and horrible. I find that a fascinating thing. For me, it's having control over something and allowing people to kind of experiment with people. I guess it says to me that I'm a controlling personality.
Are you a control freak in your real life, in your day-to-day life?
I think we'd have to ask the team about that. I think probably they would say absolutely he's a control freak, yes.
Well, were you big into video games as a kid, or did that part of it come along later for you?
Well, if video games had been around, I would have been absolutely...
Well, certainly, you're not that old.
No, I am. I am. I can remember absolutely clearly. I can remember what the weather was like the day I first saw a Pong machine. And it was in our local electronics store, and I walked past it, and I literally, my jaw fell. And I thought, I've got to have one of those. And so I went back home, and I must have been about 16, 17 at the time. I went back home. I didn't have any money at all. My grandmother was staying. I went and stole the money from my grandmother's purse. I came back. I bought this Pong machine. I got home, closed my bedroom door, started playing with myself on the Pong machine.
Yeah.
And my first thought was, this is incredibly boring. So I took the machine apart and never worked again. That was my first exposure to computer games.
Interesting. So
it entirely changed my life.
So it was love at first sight until you actually played the game.
Until I played it, and straight away I thought, there's got to be more. You know, there's got to be... And, you know, Pong, it's just the bat going
out.
There's just got to be more. And so that was my first... real exposure to a game that you could own. Of course, there were arcade games, but not a game. And then after that, there was a whole series of home computers and stuff.
So if you were a teenager at this point, does that, you mentioned that everything changed at that point. Yeah. Did, did you suddenly think, I want to be a game designer and do this better than Pong?
Well, I mean, the other thing was that what it absolutely did to me is that it is such an interesting story, and it would take so long to say and tell. But up to that point, literally up to that point, I was pretty rubbish at everything I had done in my life. I was the worst student at school. I was the bottom of every single table.
So what were you interested then? If not schoolwork,
nothing. And then it was virtually a hooligan. It was a moment I saw, and my analogy is I saw that Pong machine and it changed everything in me. And because I saw it, I decided, right, I need to learn about computers. I need to be able to learn to program. Yeah. So I then applied myself and I then went and got the qualifications. I could go to university, and then I went to university. I did computer science, and all because I'd seen that one machine.
Yeah. So did your grandmother forgive you in time?
She never knew.
Never knew.
She never knew.
Never knew.
To this day.
What did your parents... I mean, were your parents... compassionate or strict? Were they, you know, if you're a poor student, are they frustrated with you? And then do they recognize this Pong and these computers as sort of as this catalyzing force for you, or do they brush it off as, oh no, that's just a distraction, Peter. You shouldn't spend your time with that.
I mean, if you ask my mother now, she would say, oh, I was always proud of you, and you know, I knew you were going to do great things. But they really wanted me to be an accountant. I absolutely wanted me to be an accountant. My mother...
Was that the family business?
It wasn't the family business. I don't know why they wanted me to be an accountant. I mean, I was probably the worst personality of an accountant. I can remember that they interviewed me. There was an interview for a school which specialized in accountants, you know, training young accountants. Mm-hmm. Unusually, my mother came along to the interview. Normally, that mothers aren't supposed to come along to the interview. And I'm kind of sitting there, and, you know, I was a very shy child. And my mother said, yes, I know Peter's going to be good at, going to be a great accountant, because he always wins at Monopoly. But I never got offered a place in that accounting school, and thank God I didn't. But to the point I saw that machine, I was just rubbish at absolutely everything.
What did you want to be? I mean, I know if you said you sort of weren't interested in anything. What was the original vision for what you wanted to be when you grew up?
Yeah, if there had been computer games about, I would have wanted to be involved in that. Yeah. And when I saw it, and then I wanted to be involved in it. Up until that point, I wanted to run my own business. Absolutely. And I don't know why I imagined that. My first business was when I was 12 years old, where I rented out my sister and her friends to clean, to do other people's gardening. And I used to, you know, these 8-year-old girls used to go off and do other people's gardens. I used to collect the money. I mean, they were slightly immoral, I suppose. But it was much more innocent days then.
Yes.
And then my next business was when I was at school, because I went to boarding school. I worked out, realized that If you lent money to unpopular children, then you got the money back. So I used to lend money at exorbitant interest rates. So I always had these little business.
Little schemes.
Yeah, little schemes.
You're a schemer.
Yeah. I was a schemer. not a nice child. You wouldn't want to invite me home to, you know, you wouldn't want to be, I wasn't invited to many play dates, let's put it that way.
So is it a coincidence then after your mother tries to do everything in her power to get you into finance and accounting, that your first game, when you finally took a shot at it, was called The Entrepreneur, and it was a business sim, effectively, yes.
It was a business simulator on home computer called the BBC Micro. And I don't know if the BBC Micro ever was released over here.
Doesn't ring a bell for me.
It was kind of like a Commodore 64 type of thing.
Yeah.
And I had this tiny little business called Vulcan Computing. And Vulcan Computing,
Star Trek reference, or?
It was Vulcan, the god of war.
Okay.
I think it was. Yeah, it was just the, you know, I was in this tiny little this office made of cardboard boxes. The whole office made of cardboard boxes, and in the corner of this warehouse. And the business did. My business idea was to sell floppy disks. These are 5 1/4 inch floppy disks to schools. And my USP for doing that is that the floppy disks would have free software on it. And some of that free software was what I realized, that people actually just wanted the software. They didn't want the disks. Anyway, as part of the business, what I also decided to do is, I'm going to make a game. And in those days, Ryan, all you had to do is move a few colored pixels across the screen and allow the player to shoot it, and you'd have a success. It was so easy to...
And you could do it by yourself. You didn't need a team.
Oh, absolutely. You didn't need a team. You could do it by yourself. So what did I decide to do? It was effectively a business game, god game.
Yeah.
Really, it was. And I was so convinced this game was to be a success. There was no publishers in those days. I published it myself, took an advert out in a magazine. And I phoned up a local post office. And I said, look, I'm just releasing this game. It's going to be a mega hit. You might want to put on more postmen. I had a post box in the front. Very confident, yeah. I had a post box in the front of the office. And I thought, I went in there. It's just not big enough. They're just not going to get that. So in those days, you had to write in with a check. There wasn't any PayPal or anything like that. You wrote in with a check in an envelope, and I thought, this post. So I cut this massive hole in the bottom of the door so that the post could come in. Anyway, cut a long story short.
No one
bought it. Two copies were sold, both of which I suspect my mother bought. And, that could have been the end of my career in the computer games industry.
Well, that's... So, yeah, because after that, if I have my history correct, you started a business called Taurus Impex Limited, which... please explain this to me. A company that exported baked beans to the Middle East.
To the Middle East, yeah.
With a business partner named Les Edgar.
Yeah.
What? What?
Right.
Please explain this.
The whole story was, and I'll try and make it as short as possible. I had this girl I really fancied, really called Camille. Her name was Camille de Kock, and I wasn't a good looking bloke. And she had her father kind of took a shine to me, and he said, I tell you what you're going to do. I'm going to give you the contacts so you can start up an import-export business.
Yeah.
And he gave us two contacts. One was this company, which is crazy, really, company in Switzerland that needed us to get money systems for them. This sounds very strange. You know, in slot machines, we shipped them out to them, and they ordered about two of those a month, and we made about $10 on each one. And the other one was this company in the Middle East, which acted as a distributor for baked beans. Sadly, baked beans aren't that popular in the Middle East. Can't understand why. Maybe it could be the result, you know, if they were more popular in the Middle East, we may not have the problems over there. But we used to ship out these horribly cheap baked beans to the Middle East, and we made about a quarter of a cent per crate of baked beans when we shipped out. Anyway, this was going on, and the business was just about paying for enough for me to eat.
Yeah, not beans, I suspect.
No. In fact, I ended up eating a lot of the bean stock. When one day a company called Commodore phoned us up. And they said, look, we make a home computer called the Commodore Amiga, and we would love to show you our product. It's going to be coming out really soon. We'd love to show you our product. And they invited us in. They sent a chauffeur-driven car to pick us up. Now, bear in mind, all we were famous for was shipping out bacon.
Yeah, and you're still, what are you, 18, 19, 20
No, I must
point?
Be, at this point, I must be 20, early, okay. early 20, you know, yeah, 20-something, 23, 24.
Yeah.
They took us out, they showed us around their factory, showed us the Amiga. They said, we would love for you to put your product onto our machine.
So they give you a bunch of free computers.
They gave us a bunch of free computers. And that's when I realized that we were called Taurus Impex. There was another company called Taurus, spelt T-O-R-U-S, like the thing. And they made networks. We just shipped out baked beans. But I lied.
So a straight-up mistaken identity. They just didn't realize they were talking the wrong Taurus.
We had the Amiga number 6. The sixth Amiga, all signed by the people, and from there that gave me the computers, so that I was able to start fiddling around with these computers and messing around with them, which kind of led to Populous.
And that's some yeah.
A lot of crazy things out in the middle.
So that somehow leads to you start Bullfrog because you decide I better do something with these.
Yeah,
computers
exactly.
And maybe make a game.
That's right.
Make games.
Yeah, we had these computers. The baked bean business was rubbish. The money systems weren't being awarded anymore. And that's when I thought, right, let's start, and I'll do a game.
Yeah.
I'll write a game. And it wasn't a really snappy name, Taurus Impex. So thought of Bullfrog.
Sounds important.
Yeah, it sounds important, doesn't it? It wasn't. And we started working on it again. The first thing that we did...
You're quoted as saying that you bullshitted your way through Bullfrog's first game, which was a port, a translation of a game called Druid 2 Enlightenment. How do you bullshit your way through your first
I'll tell you how, Ryan. It was with I had a friend called Andrew Bailey. And he said, oh, I've got some friends who've done this game called Druid 2 Enlightenment on the Commodore 64. And they're called the Carter Brothers. And
File that name
for later. I never met them. And he said, Firebird would give you £4,000. That was, I was so poor in those days. I was disgustingly poor. I won't even begin to tell you where I showered, but that's for another time. So I had a meeting with these people. Now, bear in mind, I hadn't done any games programming before, and I can remember this meeting. This guy called Tony Beckwith, who's still in the industry today, still hasn't forgiven me even today. And so Tony said, "Right, Peter, what frame rate can you do the game in?"
Oh,
shit. A frame rate. So I said, 5 or 6? And he said, only 5 or 6? Well, I mean, 5 or 6 to start with, but then going up to 10 or 15. He said, it's got to be 30. I'll double that, almost. It was complete and utter bullshit. And then I got this game, it was done by, programmed by Simon and Dean Carter and this guy Andrew Bailey, and they'd done a pretty good job of it. I actually, from the way they laid out the code, I learned an awful lot from doing that and did the conversion.
So, not unlike Pong, you effectively learned by deconstructing Druid 2 and reassembling
it on
the Amiga.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Already your career is a series of insane
Absolutely.
Breaks and coincidences.
So, totally.
It's unbelievable, and we're just getting started. So after that, that clearly goes well enough.
Yeah.
And
well, yeah, it 4,000 was enough money to keep me in baked potatoes, and I was, working my way through those tins of baked beans and to enable me to not have to live so hand to mouth, and that enabled me to think about other games.
Like Populous. Mm-hmm. You come up with the concept for Populous, which is a Hall of Fame caliber game. Yep. It's sold 4 million copies.
Yeah.
At what point with Populous, obviously you must have thought it was a good idea as you went through with it, and then it sells 4 million copies. When do you know it's a huge hit?
Well, I didn't have a clue. No, taking you back to those days, you know, here's someone who really hadn't worked with anybody who'd done a game before. I, you know, converted a game, right. But I didn't know the right and wrong way of doing it. And the story behind Populous is I walked in one day and I was working, sitting next to someone called Glenn Corpus, who was this graphic artist. He was employed to do the graphics on Druid 2. And he was messing around with these isometric blocks on screen. Yeah. And I said to him, oh, give me those blocks. And I just mess around with them. And I started messing around with these blocks and I thought, and that's where the story of the little characters come in. I thought, these blocks, they're kind of like an island. Mm-hmm. And so I made this island shape and Glenn drew the blue water. And I had these little characters on there. And then I thought, God, it'd be great if they, you know, all ran around. But I just couldn't, I wasn't a smart enough coder to do the route finding of these little characters. So they go from A to B. And so I started, you know, writing the code so you could raise the land up and push the land down. And that mechanic was born really out of my incompetence as a coder. And then the next thing that happened is that Glenn and I got an RS-232 cable. You probably don't even know what that is, do you? An RS-232 cable?
Maybe at some point, somewhere in my head, it might exist.
So basically, it's a serial cable that allowed you to communicate.
The COM ports.
Normally, they were made for attaching the modem to the thing, and there was a big ribbon cable.
Yeah, was that the 9 pin?
It was a 16 pin.
Okay,
I think it was 16. We swapped two pins and plugged the two of these medias together.
Okay.
And we started playing Populous multiplayer. And that really was the birth of Populous.
Yeah.
Because every day we would play it, and I'd had a simple rule: if Glenn beat me, there was something wrong with the game. It was that simple in my mind. And we carried on playing, and really no one saw it. We didn't have a publisher. We eventually me and Les took it round to quite a few publishers, and no publisher was really interested in it at all because, you know, there wasn't any shooting, and it was just too weird for them. And eventually we went to Electronic Arts, and Mark Lewis and David Gardner were just setting up the European office. And they said, okay, we'll publish it because we've got a hole in our portfolio.
Yeah, you need some content.
Yeah, we need some content. So I delivered the game. I'd never dealt with a publisher before, and the game came out, and this journalist called Bob Wade, I still know him to this day, and he was a journalist on a magazine called Ace, which I don't think ever was sold over there, came into the studio. Now, when I say a studio, it was a room that was about the size of this, and it just smelt horrible. You know, there was several life forms which used to be pizzas in the corner, and there was, you know, piles of... And, we, of course, those days, you couldn't be a coder without smoking 60 cigarettes a day. It was absolutely...
In England.
So I had this mountainous ashtray piled with these cigarette ends. It stunk to high heaven. And Bob Wade came in, and I thought, oh God, I've never met a journalist before. I thought, what am I going to do with this guy? You know, he terrified me. I knew he was a famous journalist. So I know, golden rule, take him down the pub, get him drunk. Took him down the pub. We got absolutely slaughtered. You know, had like 15 pints each. And the whole time, all I really wanted to ask is, what did you think of the game?
Yeah.
And he said, so eventually, you know, we were virtually falling on the floor.
You get it out of him finally.
Yeah, Bob, what did you think of the game? And he said, it's the greatest game I've ever played.
Wow.
And the first thought that came into my mind is, he must never play the game ever again. because he must have made a mistake. And really, that was my first inkling that this weird, crazy game was going to be this.
Please tell me that, since you worked with EA, that they, and you'd never worked with a publisher, yeah, please tell me they didn't rake you over the coals and you actually made some money on Populous.
The other funny story is that they phoned me up after it had shipped out and said, "Congratulations, you're a millionaire." Because Populous accounted for a third of entire revenue of Electronic Arts.
Wow!
For almost 2 years.
I think pre-Madden and
It was millions and millions and millions.
Wow.
What they omitted to say to me, it would be a further 9 months before I saw a single penny. And the contract was so awful. It would, you know, I think I got less than 7% of the retail price. It would, you know, to me, it was a fortune at the time. But it did allow me to, you know, it kind of gave me the confidence to start, you know, experimenting with, you know, other games, yeah.
And is, at that point, are your parents just over the moon that their son has turned from a bullshit artist into a successful game developer?
Well, you've got to remember that, for a start, you know, I was, because it took so long to get the actual money. And, you know, my parents didn't have any money to lend me anything.
Yeah.
And I was just this slightly, you know, bizarre person in computer games. You know, what the hell are you doing? Get back to accountancy college, you know. So it wasn't until, I don't think really they really realized I was, you know, there was something tangible there until the time when Bullfrog was sold,
I think. And that's, so eventually EA does come to you and purchase Bullfrog.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the point where it's a life-changing situation
because
you're able to sell the studio at that point?
It's completely life-changing.
Yeah.
It you know, up until that point, you know, I'd done Populous, I'd done Powermonger, we'd done Syndicate, but really I hadn't really made any real money because we just
put
it all back in.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until, and then Electronic Arts purchased Bullfrog, and it was a kind of cash day one deal.
Wow.
And I would say that was one of the most distressing periods of my life.
Distressing, not wonderful.
Distressing. It was awful.
Really?
It was terrible.
Why?
I think anyone who wins the lottery will say exactly the same.
I mean, there have certainly been stories about how it can be.
Because what
people come out of the woodwork on you.
What happened was, in everybody else, you know, up until that point, I was just this cigarette smoking, slightly eccentric bloke that would just work all the time.
Yeah.
And then after that point, I was a successful businessman with millions and millions of pounds. And all my relationships with people that I worked with overnight completely changed.
Wow.
I got this...
For the worse, it sounds like.
There is something really strange, and it's a very interesting thing to explore. There's something really strange that happens to you when you go from being in a place where you can afford nothing, where you know, my mail by my front door was that high because I daren't open any letter because I knew they were all final demands. I was going to beat the bailiffs.
You're eating baked beans.
Yeah, I was eating baked beans. The bailiffs were coming in all the time. You go from that to having enough money that you can afford anything. And I can remember walking down a local high street and thinking, I can afford it. In fact,
what'd you buy?
There's a really funny story. So me and Les, we just signed this deal and we got back to England. And we're walking along this famous road in London called King's Road. Some fabulous shops there. And there's a section of King's Road which has got lots of antique shops in. And I say to Liz, let's go in and buy something crazy. So so I walk into the store, and the people in London, in this particular street, are really quite horrible people. You know, they don't like... I've never been much of a dresser, and I certainly don't look...
You're the riffraff.
I'm the riffraff, you know. And so, yes, what do you want? And so I walked in, and I said, they had this beautiful table, this partner's table. And I said, I'll take that. I'll take one of those, please. Yeah. And she said, I'm afraid you can't afford that.
Wow.
And I said, I beg your pardon, I very much think I can afford that. How much is it? £3.5 million. So I had to walk out of that, out of the shop, thinking,
Jeez.
I think she inflated the price a little bit. But
I should hope so.
It just goes to show, no matter how much money you've got, there's always something which you can't actually afford.
Did you buy anything, though? Did you end up treating yourself?
Yeah, I bought a house, which was crazy. I bought this really big house, and... Everything I owned fitted into the hall.
Yeah.
And it was a big house. I bought this house, and I can remember, I had, people over and everything like that, but there was one, I'd been there for about a week, and I was sitting in this house, and I was completely, and I thought, what the hell have I got this house for? I think I've even got the furniture to fill it. I bought a fantastic car and everything like that.
So, all right, let's get back to games. I want to ask you about theme park, because I feel like theme park is, I think it's the most underrated game in your portfolio.
Yeah,
Do you agree with that? What do you think?
Well, it was the most successful game.
Yeah.
Funny enough.
But I feel like nobody ever talked, we don't talk about it now.
No,
that's what I mean.
It's because I ruined it. I made this huge mistake in America, just in America. And what I did was, I think it was one of the big retailers, it may have been GameStop, I don't know which one it was. They came to me and said, oh, we've heard you're doing theme park. We've got this opportunity. We're going to do this disc, which we'll give out to every single customer that comes in the store. If you put a demo of theme park on there, it'd be fantastic.
Sounds like a good deal.
They said, the only thing is, if you put a demo on there, we really have to have the game about a month later. You know, because otherwise people have to...
Yeah, convert those to sales and... Yeah.
Yeah. So I delivered this demo. It was a rubbish demo. You know, there's a real psychology to demos. If it's too long, people don't feel like they need to buy the game.
Right.
If it's got bugs in, they don't buy the game. It's too short. Anyway, it was a terrible demo. The game actually didn't come out for 9 more months, which meant that actually... Theme park was not successful in America at all, but in Europe it was fabulous. It was in the top 10 in Europe for 10 years.
Wow.
Every year after year, which was bizarre because I did the coding on that and I made a mistake. Anyone who knows about coding, you frame lock the game. So if it's running on a machine that's faster... It doesn't go really, really fast.
A 486 will run. Yeah.
And so it was
386.
Yeah, exactly. It'll run 10 times. And I didn't frame lock it. So it was selling for 10 years. But the bizarre thing, if you brought it, and by that time it was an Intel God knows what.
Yeah, Pentium.
You would play it. And by the time the first screen came out, everything was moving incredibly fast because it wasn't frame lock. That's how people played it. I just don't know.
Wow.
But it was fabulously successful in Europe, fabulously successful in Japan, and...
Yeah, it just seems like it doesn't get talked about in the sort of pantheon of great classics.
And then, of course, Rollercoaster Tycoon came out 6 months after Theme Park.
Yeah.
And I think it had more kind of... more serious graphics, which actually I think people in America like more. I think people in Japan like the kind of cartoony graphics. Yeah.
Dungeon Keeper.
Yeah.
Was that the beginning of your fascination with empowering the protagonist in your game to actually be evil?
Yeah, well, I can remember the whole ethos behind Dungeon Keeper is that, you know, I was getting sick of watching films, especially James Bond films, where the poor bad guy, or, you know, no one ever talks about, well, you know, how incredibly hard it must be to be a bad guy. You know, how do the recruitment...
What about his
alone,
feelings?
What about their feelings? And I thought, wouldn't it be just really funny to make a game where you run the dungeon?
Yeah.
Where you're the bad guy and all of your minions, they're just bad and evil, and the good guys come in and they're just sickeningly good. And that really, that's what happened. And funny enough, the people I work with this guy called, these two people called Simon and Dean Carter.
Again, referenced them earlier, and we're going to get to them in the...
And it was only after working with them for 6 months that I realized they were the two Carters that did my first conversion, which was a bizarre thing.
Oh, so that was a coincidence?
It was purely a coincidence.
Wow.
They didn't know I'd done it. I didn't know they'd done it.
That's crazy. So why then, why did you leave Bullfrog in the end? You know, you were there, you'd built this company and then sold it and it were successful.
It was really, really immaturity, if I'm honest.
Yeah?
I'll be honest with you. And, you know, it was very confusing time for me, incredibly confusing time. And I don't think I was mature enough to really deal with all the things that was happening.
Meaning the success, or...?
It was a success. Success was one thing. Another huge thing was that Electronic Arts had said, right, I want you to grow Bullfrog to be much, much bigger. So over the course of about 6 months, we went from an office of 30 people into about an office of about 300 people.
Wow, that's difficult.
And you've got to remember the 30, I'm not asking for any sympathy because, you know, there's none's necessary. But when you're working with a team of 30 people, there's a relationship you build up. You know, you eat together, you sleep together, you dream these dreams together, which you can't do with 300 people.
Yeah, I suspect almost an unspoken understanding of, you know, I know what you're going to do, you know what I'm going to do, but if there's 300 people, you have no idea how all the pieces
That's right.
fit.
That's right. So there's that side of it. Then plus, you know, there was this fascinating thing of being a senior vice president of Electronic Arts, and that had a burden to it, which... although fascinating, and I learned an enormous amount from these guys, it did mean I did an awful lot of traveling. I did an awful lot of things which weren't to the core of what I was, which was a designer and a coder. So I think putting all those things together, I kind of felt that that maybe it would be best. I'm going to tell you the real story now.
Please,
this is a terrible story. It really.
That's what the show is
for. It's going to show
the real story
in such a bad light. So, I was thinking about, you know, what should I do? You know, should I say to Electronic Arts I want to resign as vice president? Should I say that? And I had invited a friend of mine round, who I've been working with for years and years, called Tim Rantz. And he was the technical director, and Tim and I got very drunk. This is the absolute truth. We got very drunk, and Tim said, yeah, you should leave, really. You know, what's the point in staying? You should leave. And I said, yeah, let's write the email. And so I write out this email. Dear Larry, it was Larry Probst. Dear Larry, thank you very much. This is mine. I'm handing my notes in officially. Thank you. Peter. And to my horror, Tim pressed send.
Oh, no.
And, of course, I never would have done it. I mean, it was the worst possible way to hand your notice in. It was terrible.
Don't Don't
type emails. Yeah.
Well, do you call Larry and just explain the situation?
It started a whole chain of events off, which were kind of impossible to stop.
Huh.
And it started these, you know, the straight away they got very, as you would. And as actually Microsoft did as well, they got very paranoid about me leaving and taking everybody with me and setting up a new studio.
So you put the thought in their head with your drunken mistake.
Exactly. It was too late, you know, to actually... So they actually said very quickly, they said, right, we don't want you to come into the office anymore, which was terrible for me.
Oh.
It was like ousting me from my family. Don't come, but you completely understand it, Ryan, you know. And don't come into the office anymore. We're going to shut down Dungeon Keeper, and we want you to act out your notice period in a guard, in what's called garden leave, where you sit and do nothing. And I said, there's no way. Look, I would rather finish Dungeon Keeper under my own steam. So we actually wrote most of Dungeon Keeper at my house.
Wow.
And you know, with Simon and Dean Carter, Mark Healy, who now runs Media Molecule, John D. Barnes, who's a senior producer at Bungie,
yeah.
Tony Cox, who's a senior engineer at Microsoft, and me. Yeah. It's just seven of us did it.
So, would you take back that email if you could?
I yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
it was such a silly thing.
Wow,
it was just so unprofessional. You know?
That's a story.
Yeah,
that's.
Yeah. And I don't think I've ever told that story.
I mean, honesty is good.
Right?
I'll take it. I mean, it's again, this is why I love doing this, because these kinds of great stories. So that actually segues us perfectly into the next chapter of your career, which is Lionhead.
Yeah.
So you found Lionhead.
Yep.
So what came first, Lionhead or the idea for Black and White? Did you start the company and then figure out what to do, or did you have this, you'd ousted yourself from EA and had this idea for Black and White and figured, I need a company?
I was thinking about... I definitely had this thought in my mind, is that people have been asking me about, you know, AI and computer games and emotion in computer games, and for quite some time now. This is the sort of late 90s.
Yeah, that was a big frontier that Half-Life did a lot for.
Yeah,
people
exactly.
were eager for these breakthroughs
in
game AI.
And I, you know, so there was an idea buzzing around in my mind. It wasn't exactly what Black and White was before we founded the company, but it was close enough. And so we founded the company, and then we worked on the idea. At this point, it's worth just touching on the crazy way that I approach games development.
Please, and
I think this way of approaching game development is the most insane way of doing it, but the really successful games have been developed this way. I've been so lucky that, you know, I've worked with people to enable the success. And the way is that I approach it is I always have a... It's not an idea that comes first. It's a feeling that comes first. And like with Black and White, it was the feeling of control again, like a populace. And you've got to remember that, I had done Theme Park and I'd done a Dungeon Keeper. But in a way, it was a further away from that control, because Dungeon Keeper had an element of life to it, but it wasn't quite as what I wanted. I wanted a real living world. Going back to that little short story that I read. Having a feeling for an idea, and then working with the people I work with. There's one person I work with, and I've worked with on every single game that I've ever done, called Paul McLaughlin, except Populous. And he, what he and I do, and we're working on this new game at the moment called Legacy, and he does exactly the same. He makes this idea that I've got as physically as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So he'll build model, physical models of it, or we'll talk about how we can get to the feeling that we want. So in black and white's case, he made this landscape out of wire mesh.
Wow.
And put this you know, a plaster of Paris over the top, and made all these little models, and we had this little this character made out of Lego, actually, you know, as a scale representation. In my last game called The Trail, instead of physicalizing it with something like that, we actually went on these walks. I've got these hilarious videos of us walking and exploring the game idea. So that physical side is really important. And then the next thing is to start down the road of development. Now, that road hasn't really got concrete design documents to it. It's all about, and this is where I've gotten into such terrible trouble, it's all about trying an idea out, seeing if it works, and normally I think of those ideas as like they have a life of their own. If they are good ideas, they'll survive in the game.
Yeah.
If they're bad ideas, they'll wither. In Fable's case, I'll give you an example of that bad idea. And then, you know, trying an idea out, failing in it, trying another idea out. But it's always true, the heart of the game really comes a little bit later. So the three stages are the initial thought of the idea of the game, the physicalization of the game, and the experimentation. So it's a very, very kind of, it's a very abstract way of working, very hard to predict how long something will take.
Would it be fair to say we probably wouldn't teach that way in a game design university?
I don't think we would, no.
Yeah,
no,
but it works for you.
It definitely works for me, and I think the great thing about doing this way of development, what you don't do is you don't say, I want to make one of those. I want to make a role-playing game, I want to make a...
Yeah.
You know, Fable didn't start out as a role-playing game.
Really?
No, it didn't start out.
What did it start out as?
It started out as something called Wish World, and it was about wizards fighting on the landscape, kind of on the magic carpet engine. That's how it started. You know, the original Fable didn't have any morphing character in it at all.
Huh.
That came an awful lot later. It kind of came as a result of not being able to fit enough bars on screen. So we said, why don't we have the character itself reflect what it is? Anyway, it's a very interesting way of working.
So
The great thing about that is you're never sure where the game's going to go. The terrible thing about that is you have to have a team of people that totally embrace this idea of experiment, fail, experiment.
So there is no... Are you saying there is no design document for most of your games?
It's terrifying how small the design document is.
Huh.
It's a little bit different nowadays because you don't finish a game now, and so at the moment what I've got is I've got a fantastic team of people who do design documents when on the locked features.
Mm-hmm.
But if you saw a design document, it's 99% visual. It's pictures, right? You know, this leads to this, this leads to this. I'd be totally happy for you to have a look at some of the early design documents for any of the games.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I wonder, I mean, that's, your games do have, I think it's very fair to say, and certainly for me, that there is a sort of a unique charm, whether it's Populous or whether it's Dungeon Keeper or Black and White or certainly Fable as well. And maybe that's where it comes from. Is that sort of starting with a feeling rather than necessarily a design document.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It is. So anyway, when we start going back to the start of Lionhead, when we started Lionhead, the idea was we had this landscape, we had a creature, but really nothing much else. And then it was bringing this team together, and that was the gee, that team was just breathtakingly brilliant. You know, if you look at Black and White back in those days, it came out in 2001, and we first did a demo at E3, I think in 1998, and there was this amazing thing happened at E3. We had, you know, a queue of people queuing up to see this demo. And it was just so far ahead of its time, really was. It, you know, we said, I remember us saying, right, we're going to have a game without any interface. It's just going to be a pure view on the world. And we kind of stuck to that. And the AI was real AI. It was proper.
It was very good.
Proper AI, you know. And the creature itself had a belief system which the player could play around with. It had desires and it had actions. And there's this famous story when Richard Evans, who was this genius AI coder, when we first managed to get the creature working, he was kind of standing there and he was kind of swiping his arms down towards his legs, and we couldn't work out what was going on. And we'd given him the desire to eat as one of his fundamental desires. Mm-hmm. And he looked around the world for things to eat, and he looked for the most nutritious thing to eat, which was, of course, his legs.
Oh, the legs. His legs.
So he was trying to pick his legs up to eat his legs. But it was a fantastic, fantastic time.
So, and Black and White, even though it took longer than anticipated to release, when it finally did, it was incredibly well received, incredibly successful.
Yeah.
You funded it yourself.
Yep, I did.
So that's extra satisfying, right? When it does well, and it's you don't have the corporate overlord to answer to.
Yeah.
And I mean, is Black and White the game you're most proud of in your career? Would you say? What do you think?
It's impossible to answer that question, Ryan.
Okay.
It's like saying which kid are you most proud of? You know, everything. Black and White was, it had its huge tensions because, you know, although at the time it seemed like I made an enormous amount of money out of Electronic Arts buying the company, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't gazillions of dollars. And running a studio, as anyone would tell you, is very expensive.
Yeah.
And, after 4 years, that's a lot of money, a hell of a lot of money. So it was getting pretty scary towards the end of that, but it was, the team itself was just incredible, and we worked so very, very hard. I think I worked, this is before I was married and had children, I think I worked for 9 months. I worked every single day for a minimum of 14 hours.
Wow.
And I loved every second of it. My holiday was E3. That's when I had my time off with E3, and it was fantastic time.
So after that, then you moved to Fable.
Yeah.
And you just mentioned what Fable started as, and finds its voice as Project Ego, as Fable.
Yes, yes, yes.
Which Fable's the best one, in your opinion? Because the three core ones are very different from
one. They are very different, yeah. I think, for me, it's Fable 2.
Me too.
it's. I think we were finding our feet in Fable 1, and, you know, there were some things that really aggravated me that we couldn't do. We couldn't make it more, Fable 1, more open world, possibly because the system just didn't have enough money.
Right.
We had this ridiculous thing where I had said in the press about, you should be able to plant an oak.
I had to ask you about it.
And then the ridiculous, this is the way I worked. You know, at one point in the game did have acorns that you could plant that would grow into trees.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is the Xbox One we're talking about.
The original Xbox.
Yeah, the original Xbox, not the Xbox One, it's the Xbox, you know, initial one. And, you know, Fable was pretty much, well, pushing it. So Fable 1, there were some technical restrictions there. I thought that it was it was a little bit too piecemeal. I love the human. I love the world that we created.
Absolutely.
Absolutely loved and adored it. And I thought it could take it a long way. And then Fable 2 was all about getting to the emotion of the player and getting people to care about it, making the choices a lot more meaningful.
Enter the dog.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
What is it about Fable that you think made it great?
I think it was, firstly, I'm English, so it's very hard for me to critique in anything that I do and call it great. But I think for me, it was a mix of humor. I think the humor was incredibly important. I think it was in a world that was genuinely fascinating and very creative. And I think Dean Carter did a fantastic job of coming up with creatures and ethoses and story bits, which were truly fascinating and very unique. And I think it was, especially Fable 2, it tried to be accessible. You've got to remember that back in those days, a lot of role-playing games were quite inaccessible. They were quite complex and dense. And, you know, one of my criticisms were when I played role-playing games, you kind of had to play them every single day because you very quickly forgot where you were and who you were and what you were doing and what this power-up meant. And I think that Fable tried to kind of challenge that.
Do you have any, you know, you've been on record admitting your mistakes you thought happened with Fable 3.
Yeah.
Time being a big one. You thought you know, it was rushed. But
Do you
have any regrets about Fable? Because it was your last one was The Journey, the Kinect project.
Yeah,
but just in sort of with the series in general, do you have any regrets with it or no?
I think that there was a big mistake that I made. I think it's going to be quite a surprising one, I think. I think we moved through time too quickly. I think we went Fable 1, Fable 2, 500 years have passed, and I think that should have been 50 years.
Hmm.
I think we lost. It meant that the world jumped. And the same with Fable 2 to Fable 3. Again, the world jumped into a more of a kind of inspired by Victorian times. And, you know, I love the fact that Bowerstone had kind of grown into this more industrial thing, but it was too far forward, and that meant that we kind of ran out of time. You know, where do we go next?
Right.
Fable in space. I mean, that didn't really fit. So I think there was that arc to it. I also felt that I really loved the Teresa character. I really loved the arc that she was on. She
sure.
started this little girl, this little innocent girl with the sight, and she ended up as being one of the most powerful characters in the universe. And I think she really, in Fable Journey, she was wasted a little bit. The end of her arc should have been so much more than it actually turned out to be, and that was a little bit of waste. So yeah, I think you always have regrets about these things. So yeah,
Fable: The Journey, which I reviewed it for us. It, for me, it was fun when Kinect physically allowed it to work, which was about half the time.
Yeah,
in my recollection. Did you guys volunteer for that project, or did Microsoft come to you and say, we could use some Kinect games, can you help us out?
I find it hard to remember the exact sequence of...
Yeah.
Because you've got to remember there was... Kinect came, there was a Milo thing...
I'm going to ask you about that in a
minute. And then there was Fable: The Journey... And it's kind of a little confused in my mind about the order of when these things happened. But, you know, Kinect, I'll be honest, it was a disaster. It was a disaster, Ryan. It was a train wreck. It started as this device which kind of could do everything itself.
Yeah.
It didn't take up any processor power. The field of view was you know, could encompass the whole room.
Right.
The audio on it, which no one really talks about, was originally supposed to be, you know, multi-sensing. It could sense where you were, where you walked across.
Yeah.
It ended up being none of those things. Mm. It ended up being a device which was, you had to sit in a very small arc to get it. And as you said, its promise... The promise of when Kuda walked out on stage and went like that was so enormous. In fact, it reminds me a little bit of VR at the moment. Is the promise is so big.
Yeah.
You don't have to say anything. You just think, oh my God, my console can see me.
Right.
That's the promise. But the actual delivery of that promise fell so far short. You had to go like this. It was such gross motions. And so when you were, you know, for me, the Kinect was always about me being physically in this universe.
Right.
And it wasn't about doing this, about throwing things or hitting things, because that was too exhausting. It was about relaxing. And I kept on saying over and over again, you cannot play Fable: The Journey or any Kinect game unless you're drunk. Standing up,
yeah.
We just don't want to
so
do
you
it.
Set it in the coach.
Yeah, so that's why we set it on the coach, and you know it was such a real tragedy that the team did as good a job as they possibly could to try and bully Kinect into being, you know, compliant. But you know, if you could, you know, and this is what was in my mind. I imagine doing this. You know, sure enough, it was all about casting spells. If I wanted to cast a spell, I want to do that. You should get a fucking amazing spell.
Cool fireball, right?
A very, very cool fireball. But if I really wanted to feel powerful, it was doing this, a flick of the wrist. You know, if there's a little hob coming towards you, you could just do that. It would feel lovely. It would feel fantastic. That was out of the question. It was just out of the question. And so the scope of Fable: The Journey, when I first showed it, it was riding on this wagon, which with the horse's reins. And we kind of tried to do... And our intention was to try and make it an open-world game. That why not? Why not have this wagon that's going from Bowerstone to all different... And we had to narrow it down more and more and more as we realized that it was very difficult... to work with Kinect.
Oh, that's it's too bad. That, maybe I mean, well, with the VR and the, you know, the Vive controllers or moves.
Yeah,
maybe,
I mean, it would be really interesting. I mean, actually, it's very interesting you talk about that because, you know, I've been looking at VR a little bit, and it's quite a tricky device, and for me the reason it's so tricky is because it's all about how comfortable you feel.
Yeah.
And I find it very difficult to use, and maybe it's just me, when I have to look around a lot. Now, everyone's going to want to look around to start off with, but if the game relies on you doing this the whole time, you know, you're going to get dizzy, super dizzy. And so something like riding, you know, navigating with a horse and a trap would mean that you don't have to look around so much because we could help you with guiding it around anyway. That's how I'd feel.
So after the way things ended up going with Bullfrog and your exit from EA, why did you decide to sell Lionhead to Microsoft in 2006?
Well, let me just explain to you. At that time, I think Bullfrog was there was this absolutely chaotic year where we had just released, we'd released Fable. It had done really, really well. We were working on Fable 2. We released, within 3 weeks of each other, we released Fable Lost Chapters on the PC. We released Black and White 2, and we released The Movies, this game called The Movies.
Oh, I remember.
Yeah, within 3 weeks of each other. And the studio had grown to such a huge size, it was like almost 300 people.
Wow.
It was utterly terrifying. And, I wanted to actually install in the boardroom a huge digital counter showing how much money within the studio was costing, because it was literally costing thousands of pounds an hour. And that was terrifying. And most of it was, you know, I said to everyone we worked with, look, we don't want to just survive. There's no point in just surviving. We want to make Fable 2. And we want to make it a great game. And the only way we're going to do that is if we partner with someone. And they fund the studio.
Right.
Because in those, and this is back in 2007, teams were getting exponentially bigger.
And yeah, on the new, the HD consoles. That
yeah, the HD consoles are coming out. Where you were talking about, you know, teams of 150, 200 people. And to cover 150 to 200 people, not many people realize this in the games industry, but there is a very strange economy that goes on being an independent developer. And that economy, and I really need a graph to show it to you, goes like this. You do a demo, you're completely unfunded, you do a demo, or you have a vertical slice or a green light meeting, and you go to a publisher and you say, right, I need to be funded to take this idea. Now, you're already down a bit because you've had to punt the money on the first thing.
Yeah.
You get the milestones, and the ridiculous thing is the milestones only pay you from that moment they sign up the project, which usually takes a long time, all the way up until the release of the game. But, and here's the problem, publishers recoup all the money they've paid you out of the sales of the game before they pay you a single penny.
Right.
So there's this black hole. They get paid all the money that they put on the table to enable you to develop the game, which is kind of fair enough. They get paid. Now, for some studios, that can mean they never get any royalties for the game. For other studios, they have to wait another few months, which means they have to sign up another game.
Ah.
And it is very difficult. Very, very difficult.
It's a cycle you can't get out of.
It's the spiral of doom that you go down. Mm. And, of course, if you're thinking of And back in those days, you're thinking of, right, I've got a passion to make a great game, to make Fable. And so I especially wanted to do this because I was getting a lot of flack in the press, and that motivated me to try and make Fable 2 as best as it possibly could be. And that was the real reason, yeah.
Wow. That's the kind of peek behind the curtain, I think, that we as game players don't often get.
A lot of, you know, a lot of people... It's a fascinating thing, and this is the absolute truth. Why aren't all games great? Why aren't they all great, Graham?
Time and money? Talent?
There's three things, in my opinion. The first is the talent of the team that's working on the idea. They have to be super passionate, super talented. The second is the amount of money. No matter how talented your team is, you run out of money unless you ship baked beans to the Middle East and you want to eat your baked bean stock, people are going to run out of money. The other thing to mention is that this industry is different now. We all used to be 20-somethings with no soap. This is me, 20-somethings with no social life that were willing to burn our life.
No families, no family.
For the love of what we do. Nowadays, people have got families, they've got children, and they need. So the first is talent, the second is money, and the third, the worst, the most fatal thing to greatness is boredom.
Huh.
Yeah, I've seen it so many times. People just get bored of developing the same fucking thing over and over again. And once a team is bored, it doesn't matter how much you pay them.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how talented they are. You're going to lose them, and so you've got to keep them. Got to keep them interested. And one of the problems we had with Lionhead was it was this glass ceiling, and I was at the top of the glass ceiling, and people were kind of saying, "Ah, well, we like working at Lionhead, but where do we go? Where do our careers go?" And so it was actually quite a popular move to sell to Microsoft.
Hmm. But given what you just said exactly, yeah. Did you worry that the studio would become a Fable churn house, just a Fable sequel house, and that exactly what you just talked about would happen?
In hindsight, I probably did. At the time, if I'm really honest with you, there was all these pulls about... You know, oh, well, Fable 1 isn't as great as it should have been, and Acorns and Promises and all stuff like that. And I thought, how can we solve this problem? And that's getting the funding
stability.
To make the game
yeah.
right and stability. There was this incredibly, increasing burn rate that was going on. And there was a lot of the staff, a lot of the people I worked with that kind of wanted to be part of a bigger thing, you know, in back in those days. So, putting all that together, I didn't really think about what would happen next. And to be fair, to be absolutely fair, when we were first purchased, that we were allowed to play around and experiment with a number of different things, Milo being one of them, yeah.
Yep, and that's a perfect segue into it. You have some very interesting cancellations, two of them, in fact.
Yeah.
I actually want to start, let's go back.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about BC.
Yeah.
Because BC is a game that very much captured my heart as behind closed doors at E3.
Yeah.
I want to say 2003, if I remember correctly, which was my first one. So, whatever, 2003, 2004, you showed BC to the press.
Yeah, open. It was everything I wanted it to be. It was an open world, swimming pools of blood, this primitive world which you could take your tribe through.
The AI of the dinosaurs and the survival. It looked incredible. Well, so how close was it to being done and what happened? Did Shane Kim and the Microsoft team at the time stop believing in it? Did you stop believing in it? I wanted to hear the BC story.
Yeah, the absolute story, as I recall, and you've got to be careful that this is substance abuse brain here.
Your version of the story.
My version of the story is this. It was all about focus. We just simply, Microsoft turned around to us and said, we're worried that you're focusing on too many different things.
You personally? Because you know, BC was being done at your satellite studio, Intrepid.
Yeah.
Not Lionhead proper.
These satellites were satellites, but they needed a... The idea of the satellites initially was, we'll help the studio, we'll help them get a publishing deal, they'll develop the game, we'll carry on with Lionhead developing our games. The reality is that they needed an enormous amount of support. You know,
Game became your game.
Exactly. It wasn't just me, it was some of the technical people and the business people, and it became an enormous... You know, I just simply didn't have the hours in the day. You know, there is one more part of this story which I should tell you, but it would take a very long time to tell you. And no one's ever been told this part of the story. It's a fascinating story.
You can't leave it hanging like that.
Well, I don't know if we got the time or that I've got the detail. And it's actually quite a shocking part of the story.
You're making it worse.
Basically, I'll sum it up.
Okay.
The City of London came to us and wanted us to float on the stock market.
I don't know what that means.
They wanted us to do an IPO.
Oh, okay. All right.
And to do an IPO, we needed a certain number of products. And they didn't give a shit about the business. They just wanted to make the money out of the IPO. Anyway, that's the foundation stone of the story, which I won't even bother going into.
Okay.
It was disastrous. It's worth going. It's a fascinating story.
But BC did move along, and you showed it to media. Yeah, as I said, so I'm curious, how far was it?
To answer that question, you have to understand about development. And how...
I know a little.
And development and that time in the industry. And this still exists. It's only recently this has stopped happening. What was happening is E3 was becoming so incredibly dominant.
Yes.
That teams would not spend a couple of weeks doing a demo. They would spend months doing a demo.
Yeah.
And they would make that demo just amazing. And it was kind of a nuclear arms race of how to make the demo more amazing. That demo didn't mean it was a great game. It meant it was a great demo.
Right, because it usually works where you break it off from the main build, right? And you polish up this E3 branch,
the
right?
The actual reality is that it becomes a living thing in itself. And this living thing, at best, can be sliced off from the main development of the game. At worst, infects.
Huh.
And disastrously infects the game. So, as any coder will tell you, when you are coming towards the end of a project, that's when your structure goes completely out of the way. It's when you... think, oh, just sod it. I'll just fix this bug. I don't care about whether it fits in the structure of it. And when you're running to E3, every demo, you know, time runs out. You've got to do the demo. And that means your coding and your structure of your project gets very, very messy. And that's what happened with BC and what happened with a lot of projects. And so what BC was a great demo, a truly great demo. But what had happened, and I think mainly because the team needed a little bit more guidance, that demo had actually destroyed any game that was there. It was just a great demo.
Huh.
So there came this point in time where, and the same had happened to Fable, by the way. Exactly the same had happened, is that it was kind of one demo. We could fix one, but we couldn't fix both. We could fix both with the right amount of funding, but Microsoft were already, you know, umming and ahhing about it. And when they said, you know, I think you should focus on one, it effectively killed off BC. But it was a very tough choice to make.
The idea was cool.
The idea was really cool, and my, you know, if I bet you that if we had continued, if Fable had faded away and we'd continued with BC, we'd be sitting here talking about BC 3, and it'd probably be some disastrous where we set in space or something. I don't know.
So then the other one, then, which you alluded to a couple times, is the real story of Milo and Kate. Another, you've already shared your feelings on Connect, but what, you know, that was, that one gets brought up a lot with you as, you know, sort of a almost smoke and mirrors thing. And so what really happened with that project?
Well, it was a little bit of a disaster. It started really when we were owned by Microsoft, and very early on in the relationship, they showed me this weird device called Natal. Mm-hmm. It wasn't called Connect; it was called Natal, and it was this.
Yeah, the code name.
It was quite a big thing that stuck on top of the monitor. It wasn't a small Connect thing, and they were talking about it being this device which had its own processor, which had a great field of view, which could recognize people's voices, an incredible spec to it. And I said, I would love to do a demo for it.
Yeah.
I've still got this demo. And it was called the Green Boy demo. And it was all completely all fake. And I did the demo, and it was shown to Dom Matrick, and he absolutely loved it. And at that time, Microsoft was very much orientated towards if Dom Matrick, and I've got a lot of respect for Dom. He has great intuition, and he's a real, you know, he's really quite eccentric. But he was very good at being laser focused on certain things. And he said, "I love this project. I think we should go ahead and build it, make it. I want you to come out, I want you to show it to Steven Spielberg, and I go around Hollywood and show it off," and that's exactly what we did. And we built this, and it was amazing technology. It was amazing technology. I can show you a video.
With the prototype of the hardware.
I can show you a video that, and probably break all sorts of confidentiality things, of it being shown to members of the public that were brought in.
Focus group.
It's amazing technology. It was in a complete and utter story. And the whole inspiration of that game was the joyful wonder that you get being a parent and seeing a child be inspired by what you do. And you could communicate it. There was lots of tricks in it, but you could talk to Milo. It doesn't seem so amazing these days because we talk to Siri all the time. Yeah. But back in those days, you could talk to Milo, and this was really pioneering stuff. We'd send that stuff off to the company called Tell Me, which was owned by Microsoft, and they would come back with what the definition of what is. We'd set up all the, because my point was, we're never going to be able to solve being actually saying anything to Milo, but if we do, we get you into the right mindset, and you say, "What are you doing, Milo?" or "Why are you climbing the tree, Milo?" We can interpret those senses. All that stuff worked. There were these magical moments of being able to put things into Milo's world. I mean, I've got a video on my computer. I was just looking through it. I mean, this is magical thing of being able to put physical things into Milo's world. All of that stuff worked. As we were doing it, every time I went over to Seattle and met with the Connect team, and we've had to narrow the field of view.
Right.
We've had to downgrade the process. And the thing was, it was breaking their hearts as much as our hearts. So all that was going on. So the spec of Connect was going down. And then while that was happening, quite surprisingly, Microsoft hadn't yet decided who Connect was for, who the audience was for, which is a very surprising thing when you think about it. And it wasn't until very, very late on they decided the audience but not too surprising, really, I suppose. The audience was for people who wanted to use Kinect in a party environment.
Yeah.
And which kind of, by the time it got to that point, was so primitive. You had to do these sort of actions before you it was kind of even recognized.
Right.
So if you think of Kinect as a party device, where the hell does Milo fit in? It was challenging enough for the marketing people to think of how to market it, and the rest is kind of history. How are we doing for time? I feel like we've been doing
Believe me, I've budgeted. So I know you're quite the conversationalist, and I appreciate it. Because these are great stories. Yeah. And in fact, because I would be remiss if I didn't... you haven't given a lot of interviews in the last couple of years. And in fact, I'm not sure if you've commented on this publicly at all. I've got to ask you, how were you personally affected? How did you feel when you got the news of Fable Legends being... shut down and then Lionhead itself?
Well, I mean, I've got to, tell you that it was a very strange day when that happened. Normally, I just sit at my desk and, work away and very rarely even get up. And for some reason, I walked over to the window and was looking out the window. And now my office is kind of here. And Lionhead, I can still see, is about 50 yards. I'm next door. And I looked down, and I could see all these people coming out, and I could just sense that something bad had happened. And, Microsoft closed the studio, and it absolutely broke my heart. I felt incredibly guilty.
Why?
I couldn't help feeling maybe I left them in a bit of a hole,
You feel like you could have.
Yeah,
done something
I would have. I don't know. I would have gone over there and shouted at people until they agreed not to close it down. And so I felt really bad about the situation, and it was like seeing a relative die. It really was. Yeah. It was utterly heartbreaking to see something which you kind of founded, and the culture that was created there, and the games that were created there, and the memories that were created there is just heartbreaking to see. I mean, let's be honest about it. I don't really know the reasons that Microsoft closed them down, but I know, and I have an enormous amount of respect and confidence in people like Phil Spencer. And so they didn't do it out of spite or anything. They probably did it for very good reasons. And I just don't know what those reasons are. And it's easy for me to stand back and say, oh, well, they closed it, they're evil bastards. But actually, there must have been a good reason. It's still incredibly heartbreaking. And, if I could whiz back in a time machine and find a way to make it so that it wouldn't close, the way I would probably do that is say, right, you guys, just work on Fable 4 rather than Fable Legends, then I would do that.
You think 4 would have been the way? If you'd still been there, you would have pushed to continue the series proper rather than take the left turn into the sort of game as service?
The thing is, the simple fact of the matter is that at the end of the day, whether you're an internal first-party studio or an external third-party studio, you've got to look at the bottom line.
Yeah.
How much does it cost to develop something versus how much it's going to make? Now, it's fine, when you look at the words free-to-play, and when Zynga were first coming out with free-to-play games, they were making a ton of money.
Oh, yeah.
A ridiculous, a shameful amount of money. And indeed, Supercell and games like Clash of Clans still are making a lot of money today. And it's very easy to put those sort of forecasts in your balance sheet and then to justify, look, we can afford this much development because our bottom line is going to be this. But as free-to-play has evolved, we've realized that it actually can only be applied to a certain type of game.
Right.
And that certain type of game certainly isn't Fable. Fable for me is an open world game. It's a game which is about people's freedom, where free to play is about constricting people and keeping them along a path so you can be predictive about their spend. I know this because I've been developing these games myself because I find them fascinating. And that's not what Fable is. And so I feel that if you just think of it as being purely empirically a financial decision, free to play is going to make us this much, which is far, far less than what it's going to cost for us to develop the game. And that seems to be the probable outcome of a decision now, that actually happened.
You're, of course, no longer at Microsoft. You've got 22 cans. Yeah. But if Microsoft picked up the phone, if Phil Spencer called you and said, Peter, we would love to... We want to reboot Fable.
Oh, yeah.
Can you form a team? Can we work together on something? Has that ship sailed, or is there still enough of Fable?
I've played on that fantasy many, many, many times, Ryan.
So you would take that phone call then.
And up until relatively recently, I would definitely take the call.
And Phil,
let's just define it.
Yeah.
If that was going to happen, there's three things that would have to happen. Firstly, I would have to be able to say that it was going to be a great game. Not just another Fable, a great game.
Yeah.
That first line, that ridiculous first line that I said, the greatest role-playing game of all time, that would be the reason to do Fable 4. The second is the team. We'd have to bring together a team of people. And that team of people, there'd be some team people that worked on Fable for a long time. There'd be some that would never touch Fable before. But a great, fascinating, wonderful team. That would be the second one. And the third one is that I could be what I am now in Fable. And that is, I am no longer a designer. I'm a coder. Hmm. That's what I think of myself as. That's what I do every day. And that is absolutely, how I define myself.
So we need to get the Carter brothers involved again.
Yeah, we'll get the Carter brothers involved. We need to get the Carter. Here's your list.
Please.
Simon and Dean
Phil's
Carter.
Listening. He better
Simon
be.
And Dean Carter. Alex Evans from Media Molecule. Mark Healy from Media Molecule. Mark Healy did all the, in Fable 1, a lot of the visual direction. Paul McLaughlin, another artist. I'd probably go for Eric Bailey on the animation side, or people like Adam Siblick, and then round those that core people build a team.
All right, we have the list of demands now.
But it's too.
But
late.
There, but
it's too late.
It's
Ryan.
Too late.
It's too late.
It's never too late.
No, it is, because now I am doing the most incredible thing. I've been reborn.
Which we're going to talk about right now, in fact. You went from heading a game studio, it was hundreds of people, with nine-figure budget projects.
Yeah.
You at one point were also the head of Microsoft Game Studios in Europe as well.
Yeah.
And when you left all that behind, you're now back to, as you say, being a coder. You're making smaller games, smaller teams. That I suspect that change of pace had to be completely intentional. Did you really just want to get back to your roots?
Well, like any decision you make in big decision you make in life, there's very, very few times there's just one thing.
Sure.
There's lots of weights on a. I always think of these decisions like weights on the scale. Some of them times they're big weights. A big weight for me leaving Microsoft was this, is that at that time, I was in a situation where I was spending a week, a month over in Seattle, and it rains slightly more in Seattle than it does in London. And that's a long time to spend away from your family.
Yeah.
I had a young son at the time, and my wife was fantastic and amazing. The understanding, it's a long time. That was a big weight for me on there. What was also a big weight is that you know, the in Lionhead, it was continuing to be big and being part of Studio Europe and being the creative director in Studio, which was a fascinating job, meant I was further and further away from being what I thought of myself as being a designer. That was another big weight.
Yeah.
Another big weight was Steve Jobs.
Explain, please.
He, for me, you know, when I saw Pong in that shop when I was 17 years old, when I saw the iPhone presented by Steve Jobs, it was kind of another moment. Mm. And that's when I realized something, Ryan, which has been spinning in my brain now for 4 years. I've had an incredible life. I've been able to work on crazy ideas and work with amazing people. And what I can't be is a coward. I've got to be brave. And being brave means doing the thing that doesn't make sense. And when I saw that phone, when I saw Steve Jobs present that phone, this one thought went in my mind. Everyone can be a gamer.
Yeah.
Everyone can have a game machine in their hand. Every single person on this planet can be a gamer. That was a life-changing moment.
I can understand that.
And I would have loved for the Microsoft Windows phone to be the iPhone, but it just wasn't. And I thought to myself, I have to go, I have to leave, I have to do the brave thing, the brave, crazy thing, because I owe it, in a way, to myself and to the industry to try and make games that this new audience, you know, what that iPhone did is created gamers. It created a whole new audience of gamers. And those gamers thought, up until that point, that games were about chopping people's heads off and murdering people. And now this device has made those people into gamers. But the type of games they're playing are just not very good. They're repetitive, they steal people's money, they're very repetitive, and they lack innovation.
Yeah.
And so I thought, you know, if I leave, I can focus more on my family, I can do the brave thing, and the brave and crazy thing, and I can start a new company up. The first thing I thought was, I've got to realize I know nothing about this world. I know nothing about free-to-play. I know nothing about Kickstarter.
Just like how when you started in
absolutely.
In computer games.
It felt exactly the same. Yeah. And I felt to myself, the first thing I did was I said, I need to fail first. And that's why I did this crazy thing called Curiosity.
You're segueing beautifully here because... You know, you had everybody wondering. It's a game. You're just clicking your way through, and at some point, it's chipping away. Somebody's going to unlock what's in the center.
Yeah.
Had you decided what was going to be in the center up front?
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that wasn't the purpose of the exercise. That was what I said to myself. What, and this is a very long conversation, Ryan. And most people watching will probably think it's a completely insanity, bullshit, and rubbish. But what fascinated me was, and I actually got people under MRI scans to prove this, what was happening to people's brains when they played these games was different to what happened to gamers' brains when they played them. Gamers, what we want a lot of the time is excitement.
Yeah.
We want to be challenged. We want the sense of accomplishment that games like Fable and GTA and all of that give us. But those games aren't successful on mobile.
Right.
Now, here's an interesting thought. You probably saw in the news that Minecraft sold 122 million people have played Minecraft. That's incredible.
Still going, yeah.
Still going. How many people do you think have played Pokemon Go? It's been out for almost a year.
I believe, in fact, just today, I believe it's 60 million?
No. It's 640 million people. I mean, Jesus.
That's a lot.
That's the entire population of the Americas.
Yeah.
I mean, crikey, that's amazing. What are those people doing? Why are they playing? And what I've found is a lot of people, and I found this with Curiosity, I found it with Goddess, and I found it with The Trail. A lot of people play mobile games. They don't think of themselves to escape.
Yeah.
They don't want to be challenged. They want to escape. They may want to escape the noise of a crying baby that's upstairs. They may want to escape at lunchtime, the tedious work that they're doing. They may want to escape the commute when they go to work. They don't have the time to hold the facts in their mind about where they are on quests and where this person is and where that person is. They just want to enter a world where their brain can go into an alpha state. And that's what the experiment of Curiosity proved. Hmm. It proved, absolutely. You could give people, and I intentionally made the gameplay as simple as possible. I mean, for Christ's sake, it was just tapping at the screen. But there were some people, thousands of people, that absolutely loved. And we had people, when we closed Curiosity down, we had people come to our office and beg that we give them a cube. They couldn't get to sleep. People couldn't get to sleep. They were using Curiosity to get to sleep. So that experiment was, as a designer, I had to work out a completely different way of designing a game. Totally different way of designing.
So, at the center was a video.
Yeah.
Of you.
Yeah.
Saying, congratulations, yeah. In this case, Brian Henderson.
Yeah.
You will be the god.
Of course.
In
yeah.
Goddess, yeah. Your next game.
Yeah.
So, is that still happening?
Absolutely. Development is still continuing, unbelievably, on Goddess. In fact, there's someone working on it at this, you know, very moment in time. Not so much on the Steam Goddess, but on the mobile Goddess. And unfortunately, Goddess wasn't... It cost quite a lot to develop, and it's still not in profit as much. And I'd love to pay Brian some money out. I'd love it. It would be a wonderful thing for me, but we need, unless I'm doing it, and there has been suggestions to pay him some money just for the PR side, but until the game makes money, we've got a bottom line which we're hoping one day it will make money, and it's still being played. You know, yesterday I think 35,000 people played Goddess.
And I think wasn't the other part of it, aside from the financial,
yeah.
Didn't he actually get to help influence gameplay decisions in the world too?
Yes,
that part of it?
He came down quite a few times,
yeah.
And he was quite. He wants to be in music, and I think he wanted to. We offered him to do the music, and I think I might ask him if he wants to do it again. And I'd love to involve him. It would be great to involve him in that, but the game needs to make money, really.
And it's still it's in early access, is that correct? Or it's still
in Steam early access.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's still features are still being developed more slowly on mobile.
Yeah. But it is. I mean, if it's really going back to your populist roots, really. That's sort of the heart of the game.
Yeah, there's another very long conversation to be had about Kickstarter.
Well, maybe we'll save that one. Because
just to sum it up, I thought Kickstarter was the utopian world which every designer would absolutely adore. It
yeah.
turned out to be a complete and utter nightmare. For me, purely for me, I think Kickstarter is one of the most fantastic vehicles, but here's the golden rules. Don't Kickstarter an idea. Kickstarter a product.
Right.
Kickstarter something that people can tangibly touch and play and feel. Don't Kickstarter we're going to make a remake of the God game genre. Because if you do, this is what happens. you end up with 27,511 people all trying to design the game together. And it's hard enough to get two people to design a game, let alone 27,000 people.
Yeah.
And so, and the goal, the rule is, it's very hard to please all the people all the time, especially when Kickstarter never gives you enough money. You never have enough money.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, by the time you've fulfilled all your pledges, by the time you've paid for development, I mean, you know, it doesn't even pay for a fraction of the overall cost of the game. So I would use Kickstarter again. I would say use Kickstarter again. I love the crowdsourced nature of it. But wait until the end. Don't do it on an idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there was the trail for mobile as well, which is out. That seems, just hearing you talk about it before we came on the air, I could sense a calmness and a satisfaction about the trail.
Well, you know, the trail within a matter of days, really, the trail was played more times by more people than all of Lionhead's games put together, including Fable.
There's that 600-something million audience.
Yeah, well, it's not quite Pokemon Go, sadly, but it's a fascinating thing, Ryan. It's actually, I think my kind of creative journey into that world is changing a little bit now with a new project I'm working on. But what you're doing is creating a world for people to love for. There's some people that have played the trail every single day since its launch on the 3rd of November. There's this entire, and it really is incredible, tens of thousands of people a day are exploring and navigating and communicating and working together in this entire continent we've created. It's amazing. It's amazing. And every 3 weeks, we release new features for those people to love, and sometimes those features are incredible features. We've given them a dog, like the dog in...
I approve.
In Fable, and you can train the dog, and you can tell the dog off, and you can walk along the trail, and one person's dog can sniff the butt of another person's dog. I mean, how cool is that? Well, maybe not sniffing butts, but, you know, it's an entire universe which people love and enjoy together and are taking places which are going to be fascinating.
So it sounds to me that you have... that there really isn't any part of you that wants to go back to AAA big-budget game design. You sound happier doing what you're doing.
You know, as I said, you know... In a way, being comfortable is the biggest sin. You know, if we're going to be creative in this industry, and I love and adore this industry to a point which is not very healthy, and then we have to investigate these new areas, whether it's VR, whether it's mobile gaming, and whether it's, you know, showing content to an audience that's never seen that content before. The thing I loved about the trail is these people that enjoy the trail have never explored a world before. They've never done the things that we just take for granted. They've never picked something up. They've never collected these things. And being able to give them that stuff and prove to them that games are more than just another
Pressure
Clan clone or a Match 3 game. They are truly amazing, and they allow people to create their own worlds, essentially, in their own mind. And, I find that just unbelievably enriching. Saying all that, my next game that I'm working on, the first game that I've coded, I'm getting the ideas in the game by coding those games. It's called Legacy. I'm not going to get myself into any trouble by hyping it up at all, isn't necessarily a free-to-play mobile game.
Okay. Well, that actually segues perfectly into my final question for you, Peter, which you're calling it legacy.
Yeah.
And you've had a very long and storied career.
Yeah.
Is that the end for you? Is legacy the end, or do you want to keep making games until
the legacy
until you leave this earth?
Yeah, the legacy, the name, it was a name that was suggested by somebody else. It originally had a different name. And so don't read anything into it about me.
Fair enough.
I feel reborn. I am now working as hard on Legacy as I've worked on Black and White, as I worked on Populous, as I worked on anything. Fortunately, I've got electronic cigarettes, so I don't have to fill up my ashtray with cigarette butts anymore, but I'm eating pizza and I'm drinking Mountain Dew. So, you know, I feel reborn. And all that fascination and energy that I had around, you know, Black and White and Fable and Dungeon Keeper and Populous, I feel that. And that's an incredible sensation to feel at 57 years old.
That's great.
And I can't wait to get back to my computer and work on the feature that I was working on this morning at 4 o'clock in my hotel room. And that's just what a wonderful feeling to do that. I'm not sure what this game's going to end up being, but I can promise you this, Ryan, you've never seen anything like it.
There you go. Yeah. Peter Molyneux, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
It was an
much,
absolute
yeah.
pleasure. Peter Molyneux, legendary or renowned game designer whose career, it seems, is just getting started.
Yeah.
Peter Molyneux, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
For more from the best, brightest, most fascinating minds in the games industry, be sure to look for new segments every week of IGN Unfiltered and new episodes every month.
Anna Sheridan, New York Times bestselling author of Supernatural Horror. Missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. Is the compass broken? Or did I turn to the second planet?
Given the circumstances of her disappearance, someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil, so to speak.
Weak radio signal. 700 meters. Closing fast.
There's no place for ghost stories and close encounters in this investigation, or any other.
I need you to find me.
To save yourself.
Of course. What else would it be?
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.